Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning into The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Wednesday, May 20th. Scores of governors and mayors from Japan are in Honolulu for a summit this week. We hear about efforts to build stronger ties to boost the economies of both places. Time, manner, place, some are questioning a move by University of Hawaii officials to change the policy on campus demonstrations. Why the Faculty Senate is asking to delay a decision on what they say is free speech. Rising sea levels lapping away at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. How long can it call a Windward Oahu Island home? And we meet a stealthy native thrush with a showy song on this week's Manu Minute. And middle school students put Hawaii on the map when it comes to drone studies. We consider the program's reach. How far can it go? Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Governor Josh Green will play host to a number of governors and mayors from Japan at Washington Place later today. It's in advance of a Japan-Hawaii summit that takes place on Thursday. The gathering aims to fortify sister city relationships and the acknowledgement of the deep economic ties that have developed in recent times. The inaugural summit was held in 2023, and this week the event will draw some 400 attendees. This morning, we talked to Dennis Ling, administrator at the Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism. A just-released report looks at Japan's investment in the islands. This report really underscores the fact that 55% of foreign-owned property in Hawaii, they're owned by Japanese companies.
Yes. That is a very sizable investment. I think most of them were made during the heyday back in the 80s and 90s before the bubble burst. And while there are still some investments, like the investment at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, it's still happening, but it is getting more and more difficult, especially with the newer investments, especially with the exchange rate.
And then the report talks about how Japan is Hawaii's number one import supplier. Talk about that.
Yes, there are quite a bit of imports from Japan. However, there's a lot of exports going to Japan also. And Japanese companies are looking at producing product in Hawaii for export to other places. For instance, rice growing is becoming quite an interesting area that we've noticed. On Kauai, the Tokyo University of Agriculture and Technology is doing research on growing premium Japanese rice in Kauai for export to the mainland, as well as for local consumption, as well as export perhaps back home too. And they can get the double premium on it, Hawaii and the premium Japanese rice. So that's interesting.
Yes, given our history of rice growing here, Jerry Ornelas and I think Grow Farms, those folks have really
that's
been
right.
pushing
yes,
into that yeah. area. Yeah, so that's a bright spot.
Very much so, yeah. And we do look at other activities from Japan that would take place in Hawaii. A lot of it might be even military connected, but because we are such a defense center. There are work that Japanese can do for the defense sector in partnership with Hawaii companies or U.S. companies to get contracts. So that would increase the employment base and help to keep some of the monies that they get for these contracts within the state.
And because we've had issues with insurance here in Hawaii, what caught my eye was this line about Japanese-owned captive insurance companies that operate here.
Yeah, we're, I believe, the largest domicile for Japanese captives. We're second in the nation, second to Vermont in being a captive domicile, and it is a growing industry. The good thing about that is they deposit funds into our local banks, and they hold their annual meetings in Hawaii, and it sets up Hawaii as a basis for future investments where we can market to them for additional activities.
And the other thing that caught my eye, I know that Hawaii is bucking the trend when it comes to international students, but the Japanese students are still the largest educational group that come here to study.
Yes, yes. Japanese students are very important to our student attraction program. It is getting more pricey for them to do so. However, that is our major market. And there is an organization called the Study Hawaii Group in Hawaii, consisting of the university as well as other schools, both colleges as well as high schools, that promote the attraction of overseas students to Hawaii. And Japan is primarily the main source here for us. And because we have such a good relationship with our sister states as well as Japan, they feel comfortable here, especially when they come here. I mean, the culture is very inviting for them. And we do try to promote the attraction more and more. But yes, it is getting difficult. But I believe the university might be offering some incentive for foreign students to locate in Hawaii, perhaps by the tuition fee being reduced to, I don't think to resident tuition, but something close to that. That would help with the student attraction. And international student attraction is very important because it not only brings people in and their parents and their families eventually to visit them, and also it opens the doors for our own students to go overseas with these school exchanges and other types of relationships that are established. So it's a win-win situation for us, and it's an area that really has to be emphasized and attention devoted to.
I know that the governor has talked about the possibility of investment by that Japanese company, JERA, when it comes to exploring the liquefied natural gas aspect. I know there's some pushback for LNG, but yeah, it's just throwing that out there as what's possible. What other connections can we make to bolster our economy? But can you talk about the tourism aspect? Because we've done everything we can, it seems like. And then now with this squeeze with the price of oil and fuel, we're watching tickets, you know, air travel just soar.
Yeah, and that is true. However, I believe the market for our visitors from Japan, it's becoming a higher caliber market. And it's the market that we initially wanted to market to. So while we are getting less visitors, we are getting a higher spending and more, sensitive traveler to Hawaii and some of the things that we want to make sure that they, you know, remain respectful to the culture as well as our environment.
Well, that's interesting because that's similar to kind of what we saw during the pandemic, right? Where a lot of the economy class tickets were open, but those in the business class and first class were booked.
Yeah, that's true. And it might seem the numbers are going down and are down. However, the spending is stable.
What else does this summit aim to do?
Well, first of all, the sister state relationship as well as this gathering is a people-to-people thing, and we want to highlight more than 60 years of Hawaii-Japan sister relationships and showcase Hawaii as a role as a bridge between the United States and the Indo-Pacific. And it will serve as a platform for renewing our commitments and launching new initiatives, and also honoring the deep historical and cultural ties that connect Hawaii and Japan. The summit will cover a diverse range of topics: health, gaming, which is digital gaming, and also sports, economic development, of course, disaster management, as well as defense.
And I understand, too, that one thing that you folks are looking at is the prefab homes for housing.
Yeah, that would be a very interesting initiative, and see how we can partner with the Japanese companies that do this. And that would be a boon to our, hopefully, our construction industry as well as to the inventory of our housing supply. So that's something that, although it's not on the agenda for this time, that is something, and we hope that But I don't know if a company from that area will be coming to the summit, but I think we want to reach out to them and make sure that they know that we are interested.
That was Dennis Ling talking with us about the Japan Hawaii Summit, sponsored by the Department of Economic Development and Tourism, that is taking place this week.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
On the next Fresh Air, how can a politician lie to the electorate and not face legal consequences? Even a lie as consequential as President Trump's claim that he won the 2020 election? In a new book, Andrew Weissman explains how we got here and suggests ways to hold politicians accountable. Weissman was the lead prosecutor in the Mueller investigation. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and take-out daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
Members of the Faculty Senate at the University of Hawaii are meeting with school leaders today to discuss what they see as a concerning change to campus free speech policies. The rules are what's known as time, place, and manner policies. Proposed changes would limit chalking and ban sit-ins at Bachman Hall, which is a popular site of student protests from the Hawaiian Renaissance to activism against the 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea. Some are questioning, why is the university making these changes now? Is it out of concern about future federal funding? Is it anticipatory obedience? HPR's D.W. Gibson spoke with Zane Castillo, a journalism student and political science professor, Dean Saranilio. The Faculty Senate is asking that any new policies be delayed to allow more time to consider their concerns. Saranilio starts us off.
What it really does is it renders protests by students and faculty at University of Hawaii inconsequential. And it doesn't allow for Indigenous peoples, minority folks, anyone concerned to have a voice to speak to the administration in moments where we have concern over the health of and safety of communities who are vulnerable. As many of the listeners are probably aware, University of Hawaii has a long tradition of protests, whether we're talking about the genetic engineering of Haloa or the 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea or defunding Olelo Hawaii, Hawaiian language, whether we're thinking about the changing of the name of Porteous Hall, who was a eugenicist, and renaming it Saunders Hall, which is its current name, that protest would have been impossible. The students who sat in at Bachman Hall, those protests are now no longer possible.
So the university, for its part, points to what they call an extensive consultation process over this last academic year with stakeholders. That includes the Faculty Senate, student caucuses, some other bodies as well, where they've had town halls, listening sessions to get reactions to the proposed changes in rules to time, place, and manner for protests. What's been the Faculty Senate's reaction to these proposed changes at these consultations?
So faculty have been very active. I sit on the Committee for Professional Matters in the University of Hawaii Faculty Senate, and our committee is specifically charged with vigilantly protecting academic freedom. And so our chair of the Faculty Senate said that if we have major revisions to the proposed rules, that we should introduce it as a resolution. And so we did exactly that. We reference the American Association of University Professors, who note that in times of authoritarianism, in times of controversial issues, academic freedom, political expression should be protected, not restricted. And if you look just at the political context that we are living in, folks from the Global South have been telling folks in the United States to hold the line, to really protect what rights we have now. And so we took those things to heart. We passed a resolution. Very rarely do our resolutions pass with such numbers, especially when they are taking a somewhat antagonistic position in relation to the administration. But our resolution passed 52-3. And so we asked that we rely on the existing rules, which do already provide protections for students who do not want to be intruded on as they go to classes. They don't want to have somebody impeding their way to class. All of those things exist in the existing rules. The current proposed rules, however, actually make it far more restrictive, far more difficult. It chills free speech. And for that reason, we passed a resolution. The Associate Student Government for undergraduate students at the University of Hawaii also passed a unanimous resolution, as did the Grad Student Organization, which is a grad student government. There was also a resolution in the legislature to support the Faculty Senate's resolution, also sort of taking note of the context, political context that we're living under, and the need to protect free speech, especially given what's going on in the world.
Zane, I want to bring you into the conversation. You and a couple of your colleagues at the Manoa Mirror, Kara Williams and Elise Perez, did some reporting on this issue. Tell us what you understand. I'm sure there's a lot of nuance that goes into all the proposed rule changes, but give us some highlights in terms of elements that you understand will be changed with these new rules.
Yeah, so some of the major changes would be like how do protests and counter-protests interact with each other? I think that the blanket ban on camping that they had initially was pretty restrictive and felt like it was in response to the encampments that happened across the country in response to the genocide in Palestine. And so seeing some of this, I've identified that there's a lot of fear in like what people are willing to say openly. And when they learn more about time, place, manner restrictions, they felt more like their voices were being preemptively restricted. And the biggest fear I've heard from everyone that I've interviewed is that this is a restriction that limits how people can speak, where they can speak. And they feel like as a educational institution, that this is an overreach, very broadly, an overreach of protections against speech on campus.
Yeah, and not just how you can speak, where you can speak, but very fine points, right? In terms of even like, I've heard so much talk about chalk, right? Mm-hmm. Where one can use chalk and apply chalk and not apply chalk.
No, absolutely. And chalk messaging over the last few years have been one of the primary modes of protest on campus. And so to have more blanket bans on that, it leads to a lot of frustration among the student body.
Dean, you listed a lot of concerns. I want to dial down on them a little bit more precisely. Do you see constitutional issues here, or is it more about the spirit of free expression and the possibility of driving up self-censorship on campus?
Yes. Yeah, so our law faculty were actually the first to come out in opposition to the proposed rules in November. And they wrote two memos that were beautifully written. They were basically pointing out that in this moment where the university is under attack, that what the university should be doing is protecting First Amendment rights, not restricting it. And they gave a long list trying to make the rules more narrowly tailored so that they could be legal. But they made a really strong point to, again, emphasize, for instance, they disagreed vehemently with the prohibition on camping. What Dee Dungaran has said that I find so useful is that even if the rules themselves can be made to be constitutionally sound, it doesn't mean that it's good policy. If we look at the history of students occupying Bachman Hall and practicing peaceful, nonviolent sit-ins, from 1968, you have stories of administrators coming downstairs to sit down with the students and create some kind of discussion and discourse and mutual understanding. That also happened under the previous president, David Lasner, would come down. You have photos of him sitting down with a sea of students and faculty surrounding him, trying to come to a common place. Those kinds of opportunities will be lost due to these rules.
And on that point, one thing that we as we've reached out to the administration for the university to understand their perspective, one thing that is emphasized again and again is that the freedoms that are at issue here are already covered by the negotiated collective bargaining agreement. But it sounds like what you're saying there is whatever language might be in that bargaining agreement in terms of protections, all of the sort of teeth of it are taken out by these potential rules changes.
Yeah, it's like they allow for protests, but protests have to be of a certain decibel level. It has to be in a particular place at a particular moment. What protests are supposed to do is it's supposed to inconvenience. It's supposed to force people to have to reckon with a particular issue that is of grave concern to a majority of students.
That was Professor Dean Sarmonullo and UH student Zane Castillo. They were talking with HPR's UW Gibson about the school's plan to add additional restrictions to protests on campus. We'll have more from this interview after a quick break.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Let's return to our conversation with Professor Dean Sarmonullo and student Zane Castillo. They're concerned about new time, place, and manner policies that the university is considering, especially given the timing of the proposed changes, which come as professors and students make their last sprint to complete coursework and grade dissertations. Here's Sarmonullo.
It's bad timing, and as a result, the Faculty Senate passed a resolution last Wednesday, basically demanding that the administration not pass anything over the summer, especially the time, place, manner rules, until we can have adequate discussion come fall. They were telling us that they would have town hall meetings come fall, but this is only after the rules have been proposed. And once the rules are passed, the only way that you're going to get the rules changed is essentially through lawsuits.
We asked representatives from the university about why the administration is seeking these changes now and didn't necessarily get an answer to that. We were encouraged to consider the national context. But Zane, I wonder if you have ideas or if things have come up in your discussions with fellow students about why now, why the university is doing this now.
A lot of it has to do with the pressure from the Trump administration, at least gathered from my conversations with some people who were more knowledgeable and less knowledgeable. The people who are less knowledgeable automatically affixed it to the threats of budget cuts when Trump first assumed office on this term. But why now? There's a larger, for example, the ban on camping on campus that feels like it's in response to the encampments that happened across the nation. And so as the U.S. enters another war in the Middle East that is widely unpopular, we see more efforts to preemptively restrict our voices so that way we can't disagree with the narrative from the federal governments.
Dean, you've pointed to the bigger picture as well, but does that sound familiar to you, that perspective? Is there anything you would add to speculation in terms of why now?
Yeah, I agree with everything that Zane said. I think the University of Hawaii has been listed as one of 60 institutions under investigation for being in violation of Title VI. So Title VI is basically, the institution itself cannot discriminate against a particular group. And what has been happening is that where previously people's academic freedom would be attacked because of a particular thing that an individual said, now that the Trump administration is in office, what they have done is they have redefined discrimination that the entire institution could potentially do. And that would justify the withdrawal of federal funding. This was mentioned at one of the town hall meetings. It was referenced in terms of student protests at other universities, itself being anti-Semitic, which is itself potentially not mindful of the fact that many Jewish students were themselves involved in these protests. And so there's that aspect. But I think there's also this other thing in regards to the effectiveness of student protests at the University of Hawaii. And, you know, the most recent protest was the Mauna Kea protest. And the university really wanted to build the 30-meter telescope. And if it wasn't for the activism atop Mauna Kea blocking the roads, combined with this activism that happened throughout Hawaii, including the University of Hawaii, students occupied Bachman Hall for 119 days. That's an incredibly long time. And I think the effectiveness of those protests lead eventually to a kind of counteraction, which I think the time, place, manner rules point to.
Is there anything that I haven't asked about that you think is really important to understanding the dynamics of the situation right now?
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, it's actually strengthened democracy on campus. The Committee for Professional Matters is active now. We are vigilantly watching what is happening nationally, but also what's happening in Hawaii. You know, free speech matters so much. The media understands this. Comedians are being fired. It's the climate that we are under necessitates courage. And faculty and administrators should be nurturing that courage amongst the students, because their voice in this generation, in this historical moment, matters so much in terms of what direction we're going to head towards. And so for a lot of us, we can't lose this. We can't lose having the ability to speak what is true to our communities and to our hearts. And we cannot create the conditions that prevent that and don't nurture the exercise of free speech in this moment in particular.
That was Dean Saranulio and Zane Castillo. They were talking with HPR's D.W. Gibson about the school's plan to add additional restrictions to demonstrations on campus. UH officials released a statement. They said that the updated policy reaffirms the constitutional rights of students, faculty, and staff to engage in expressive activities, including protests and demonstrations. At the same time, universities must balance those rights with the need to maintain a safe, functional a learning environment. The policy provides clear, more consistent expectations for when, where, and how expressive activities may occur to help prevent disruptions to academic instruction, research, student services, and campus operations.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii, located in the Outrigger Waikiki, presenting trumpeter and composer Chris Bodie, performing May 25th to the 27th in two sets nightly. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Level rise is literally eating away at the home of the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. It sits on a small low-lying island in Kaneohe Bay on Oahu. You may know it as Coconut Island or Gilligan's Island. Its Hawaiian name is Moku'oloe. The Institute has released what it calls the Malama Aina Plan, which will guide how the island adapts to climate change. Rather than fortified with seawalls, the plan proposes flood-adapted spaces that can serve as habitat for birds or even outdoor classrooms to study sea creatures. HPR Savannah Heron-Pote spoke with the Institute's director, Megan Donahue, as well as landscape designer Phoebe White and ecologist Kavika Winter. Winter says that indigenous knowledge was foundational to the plan.
The process that we engaged with is 8 considerations of pono stewardship for the islands. Teachings that I received from my kumuhula, the late John Kaimikawa, who was the last in an unbroken line of knowledge keepers stretching back 1,000 years. These teachings are about a framework of thinking and planning that is very holistic. So there are these 8 realms of consideration, the first one being Kalawalani, or the things in the heavens, the next one being Mauna Nuiakea, which is the things of the ocean from the shoreline all the way out to the horizon, as is seen from the highest point on the island. The next one is Kahakaipepea, which is the shoreline resources, which In some places, they're just small little stretches of beach, but in other places can be these massive sea cliffs, or in other places, they can be these massive, extensive sand dunes. Then you have the Malka resources, which is from where the soil starts all the way to the top of the mountain. The Muliwai are all the sources of fresh water, whether it be the rains or the springs or the streams or the rivers, all of that. So these are five considerations that have to do with the mauli, or the integrity of the space. This has nothing to do with humans. Humans come in under the sixth consideration. So humans being kanaka honua, the needs of the people, how to feed the people, how to house the people, that's a consideration. The next one is kapahi lolona, all of the forms of indigenous knowledge. Anciently, that would have been astronomy, medicine, those knowledge systems needed to be maintained. And then finally is ke'i'i, which is all of the things that were needed to maintain the sanctity and the spirit of the land. And all of these things work together to create a holistic framework such that humans could thrive without depleting any of the resources or the integrity of all these things that make our island so special.
Phoebe, tell us about how this foundation of indigenous knowledge actually shaped the process of creating this final product, the Malama Aina Plan, which will guide stewardship for the island moving forward.
Sure. It should be mentioned that Dr. Priyam Das, who's a professor of urban and regional planning at University of Hawaii at Manoa, she and I were co-principal investigators conducting this project through the University of Hawaii Community Design Center. Early on, we asked ourselves, how could this project not just serve as a model for climate adaptation in Hawaii, but how could it offer an opportunity to create a place-based framework for climate adaptation? So using this framework, the first phase really involved a lot of background research on the site in multiple formats. So we did a ton of archival research in the Bishop Museum archives, and also we did several guided tours looking at the island through different lenses. So facilities was one layer, vegetation. We did kind of a watercraft tour around the shore. And then we also did a king tide tour. And that was really illuminating because you could see the ongoing impacts of sea level rise, erosion. And so that dual type of background research, it contextualized for us the eight considerations of pono stewardship. And so, you know, we worked a lot with Kavika and Megan to create the next phase, the second phase of the project, which was all about community engagement, not just staff and faculty and students at HIMB, but also cultural practitioners who have a long, you know, even ancestral ties to Mokoloe. The communities we work with and collaborate with, they are the experts on place, right? So I think in any project, it's really important to take time to listen to what people feel about the place, their ties to it, what vision they have, that they see it being in the future. And then we took all that information we gathered during those talk stories and led a second workshop where we co-designed with community members these two projections of design, one for 3 feet sea level rise and one for 6 feet.
Kavika, when you're going through this process, was there particular feedback from the community that stood out to you or that changed your understanding of place for Moku'oloe?
I think one of the most profound things was actually the work that UHCDC did to look back at some of the very old photos that we didn't have in our own archives out at HIMB to show what the island looked like before it had been developed and altered and these kinds of things. And having that foundational image of what the island was supposed to really look like or used to look like is really important, because a lot of the work that we are doing in He'e'ia is about cultural restoration. And so biocultural restoration is it's an approach to conservation where the standard conventional approach is to identify people as a problem and get rid of people in the pursuit of saving nature. Biocultural restoration is the flip side of the coin, whereas we identify not that humans are the problem, but the problem is our severed relationship to nature. And so we try to heal and mend that relationship, and we bring people back. We revive indigenous lifeways that are at the foundation of these relationships. And having these photos of what the island used to look like are provided some of the missing puzzle pieces, at least for me in my mind, because this isn't my community, this is not where I'm from, to see how many reefs were actually destroyed by dredging. Some reefs were entirely taken out, some were shaved off, to understand the impacts that the 20th century had on the ecology of the bay is really important in understanding how we could possibly approach restoring it, especially in the context of climate change.
Median, when you are looking at both this plan and thinking about the process that went into it, do you think that the Malama Aina plan can serve as a possible template for how we prepare other places?
Absolutely. The Malama Aina plan for Moku'oloi is a way of us kind of envisioning the future and envisioning a future for this island, but also for testing out a new process and new technologies for coastal resilience. So you've heard a lot about the Indigenous framework that led the process and that helped us to take on this planning in a really holistic way for the island and to think about not just sustaining the research and education mission of the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, but in fact, to ensure that our local community and cultural practitioners feel welcome and taking seriously our kuleana to the island that we have the privilege to care for. So taking those things together, we do see Moku'oloi as kind of an exemplar for, and the process that we undertook here on Moku'oloi as an exemplar for other places in the Pacific Islands. We also, you know, are testing out new technologies here for shoreline resilience. We have an area on the island where we are kind of have tested one of these shoreline mattresses that can protect the shoreline from the energy of the ocean, but also provides habitat for marine organisms and has a dune structure with native plants on the top of the shoreline. So we're trying to also demonstrate some of these new technologies and possibilities for folks around the Pacific.
Thank you to everyone for taking the time to have this conversation. Is there anything that we have not talked about that you would want to share with the listeners while we have their ear for the story?
A really important part of the conversation that I want to be sure doesn't get missed is, you know, just getting to that exact question that you just asked Megan about what implications does this have for the rest of Hawaii? And this gets to really a larger question that I get all the time, which is, yes, we know we need to make changes, but how can we ever break out of these systems that we're stuck in to get to that place where we can actually be living in a different way? And this is kind of the silver lining in the cloud of climate change, because climate change is clearing the slate for us. And we've seen that happen in Hawaii. So I was living in the community of Haena Kauai in 2018 when we got hit with the rain bomb, which was 55 inches of rain that fell within a 24-hour period. It broke the record for the highest rainfall ever recorded for anywhere in the United States. And it devastated our community. But our community had a plan in place of how we wanted it to be. And those floods provided, it cleared the slate and allowed us to rebuild in a way that the community wanted, that was founded in Indigenous knowledge. That was the first climate storm. That rain bomb that hit Kauai in 2018 was the first documented climate storm ever to hit Hawaii. The second climate tragedy ever to hit Hawaii was the Lahaina fires. The Hawaiians definitely had a plan in place about what Lahaina needed to look like, but there was no process that the community went through that said, okay, this is our plan of how we want the future to be. They're in a difficult process of trying to create a plan in the aftermath of climate change. What we've done here at Moku'oloi with the Malama Aina plan for Moku'oloi is we have a plan in place. So when that catastrophic something happens associated with climate change, we already have a plan in place that will show us how to rebuild. The Malama Aina plan for Moku'oloi takes one of the smallest islands and made a plan for it. And with that plan will provide a template for how other islands in Hawaii, in Oceania, in the world can start to think about preparing for these changes because they're coming. So the communities that have a plan in place are the ones that are going to be more resilient, more robust, and more prepared to build back when that climate disaster happens.
We've been hearing from ecologists Megan Donahue and Kavika Winter and landscape designer Phoebe White. You can find links to the full Malama Aina plan at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
So Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We now go to this week's Mano Minute. UH Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to a native thrush found only in Big Island rainforests.
The Oma'o, or Hawaiian thrush, is found only in the native rainforests of the Big Island. It's a mostly gray and brown robin-like bird that loves to eat fruit from a variety of native trees and shrubs, and plays a big role in helping disperse the seeds of these species throughout the forest. Oma'o have one of the loudest and most recognizable songs of any Hawaiian forest bird. They have a huge repertoire of songs, and every individual sings differently. All the Hawaiian Islands used to have their own species of thrush, but unfortunately, Kauai is the only other one where they've not yet gone extinct. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, connecting the community with the Manu Oku through programs to promote awareness, appreciation, and conservation of the official bird of Honolulu. Learn more at hiaudubon.org.
Makai Middle School put Hawaii on the map when it placed first in a national drone competition in 2024, and it continues to push the envelope. A former student went on to help start a similar drone program in Australia, and next month, 2 8th graders will head to Atlanta to compete in the first national commercial drone competition that will have a middle school category. We were able to see the Eva Mackay students in action yesterday afternoon. They were piloting a drone in what looks like a batting cage for sports, but this is so much more than child's play. It was a chance to learn and test real-world skills, from developing construction surveys to search and rescue.
Are you clear for takeoff?
Rena Rose Palaktek and Rachel Kawiho are 8th graders who will represent Eva Mackay in Georgia.
So with these skills, with me building my communication skills, my teamwork skills, my integrity, and all of that, I wish to take all of those skills and build up to a career that is most fulfilling for myself, which is a career I want to pursue is aerospace engineering, and I want to head into a college that could help me gain that experience for jobs like that, for example, Embry-Riddle.
I think a lot of what the program has done for me is teaching me life skills and workplace skills that I'm able to take into whatever career I'm looking into, whatever interests me, or what I'd be able to do when I grow up and what career I choose to do. I've learned how to work with a team. I used to be very individual. I was never really good at working with other people, but through the drone program, I've learned how to work as a coder with my teammates, how to program and how to actually talk to people better and have more social and communication skills through that.
It's all about confidence, isn't it?
Yes.
And so, gosh, I mean, when you think back to when you took the first class, I don't know, does it like amaze you that you've been able to pick up these skills on mapping, whether it's solar panels on a roof or anything else?
Yeah, personally, I'm still shocked to this day that I'm able to understand all of this and actually look at those maps and know what most of it means. over the short amount of time I've actually been on this team, since I actually didn't start in sixth grade like how Rena had. I had joined somewhere in the middle of seventh grade and continued through eighth grade.
And Addison Kim is a seventh grader who discovered she loves piloting drones.
So I really enjoy doing drones. I just feel like I have a passion for it, especially piloting it. I was a coder last year, so I think coding drones is like also pretty okay, but I'm more into like flying them and piloting them. I feel like that's super like engaging and fun with me.
Is it crazy that you think that you're flying drones, but do you have your driver's license yet?
So the only certificate or like certificates that I have like for flying drones is just a trust certificate, which is basically your certificate for just recreational flying outside, and then like a co-drone certificate, specific drones like co-drones to fly.
Have you thought about any particular field, you know, that you're interested in? Are you leaning toward any one particular area?
I'm definitely, of course, leaning towards drones and aviation and more like plane stuff.
What's been the scariest part for you?
I think the scariest part would probably be just kind of like what to do next. Like, what should I do next? What is my choice? What do I go to? Like, what should my future kind of point towards too?
And then you folks are growing up in a time when technology is advancing so fast. You know, we're hearing about AI and how that's doing coding. And, you know, but yeah, what are your thoughts about growing up in a high-tech world?
I think it'll probably be much harder to get into fields that have already been taken by like lots of like AI and high tech, because then it won't have like, it won't really need the people that have the skills already. So I think that'll be like a little more challenging than it already is.
And Kao Cockett is their aviation pathways instructor, who is bursting with pride over what the students have been able to accomplish.
Kids that you saw today have been in a lot of different aspects of my program, from the after-school competitions, which we did nationals, to the industry workforce-related competitions, as well as our CTE courses, Career Technical Education, which focuses on industry use, enterprise-type use of this equipment.
And so what inspired you folks to start this program?
I started as an aviation instructor, which I still do fixed-wing flight. We have a whole side sector of engineering, fixed-wing flight, and science. And a couple of small drones fell into my lap about 5 years ago. I had a few kids, like that girl from Australia, who started the program. We were asked by Kalani High School if we wanted to come and compete in like an extracurricular team type thing. We did. The kids did great. They fell in love with it. And from there, we started an entire program. And once we won the national competition, that's when I started to embed it into the curriculum, because there was justification to start taking those skills that they learned from this competition and seeing how it can be connected to workforce. So not just for playing, but how can you move to the next level and start to adapt those skills for our future career.
And so you have a team that's going to be going off to Atlanta at the end of the month, and they're going to be competing on a much higher level.
Yeah, so along with the delegation of other representatives, everything from architecture to advanced manufacturing, the two girls that you met here will be representing Hawaii in the middle school division for commercial drones. So this is an industry skills competition, which focuses on, do you have the workplace ready skills to actually jump on the job site on day one and be able to thrive in that industry?
And so this is the first time that there will be a level for middle school?
This year is the first middle school national division of the competition. The high school college division has been progressing for about 4 to 5 years. We have been competing in the last couple of years against high schools and have been placing against them. But it's nice now that a new division was opened that we'll actually be able to represent at our middle school level division as well.
Do we know how many middle schoolers from across the country will be competing?
I'm unsure, but every state has one delegation. So in theory, if every state had a competition team for this, there may be 50 states competing.
So how many students do you think have gone through this program since you started?
So our Eva Mackay Aviation Pathways consists of four different classes, three different levels of drone, from beginner to application to workforce, which we call CTE. And then we have two courses, fixed wing aviation and engineering. So sometimes the drone is just a stepping stone to talking about things that fly. And a lot of my students who are now in high school and beyond started with drones and are now working on their private pilot license and looking at careers in aviation if they're not just doing drones. But drones, a lot more recently, are starting to get a lot more commonplace in the commercial space with drone delivery starting to be a thing, bigger drones. There's a lot of regulations changing. So in our lifetimes, we're going to start seeing this commonplace from everything, from washing your solar panels, painting billboards, delivering your pizza, construction site logistics, film, which the creative part is always a use case for a tripod in the air.
It's just amazing to me to think that these students are going to have this amazing leg up, you know, with their careers.
I think since the beginning of our programs, the question has always been, okay, what's next? What do they do after this? And my plan has always been, we grow it from the bottom up. Because this technology is going to be so commonplace and it's not going away, our kids are going to start in the field running with the crew resource management, safety, set up operations in order to thrive in a lot of different things. We've worked from Hawaii's fire department, their drone team, with Captain Robbie Mai, who started that program, and we went over how to do search and rescue piloting from the public safety sector. We've worked with drone operators who do solar site surveys, construction surveys, LIDAR surveys, film, fly through film. And I bring them in, they meet the kids, and they basically, in my high level, my level three, they learn the workflow cycle for that particular career. So it's not a show and tell. Our question, our ask is always, how do we do what you do? And then they learn it, we practice it, and then they execute it. So we've developed kind of a proof of concept that it can be done even at this level. And I'm excited to see what happens in their future for 5-6 years, having this head start.
This must be just so, I don't know how to express it, but the fact that these kids are out there way ahead of, you know, a lot of what we're learning.
I'm extremely proud of what our community has been able to accomplish. You know, having interested students, having an interested teacher is great, but it really takes all of the different components from our industry partners in the community who, once we've brought in, have always been supporters. Once we get them in the doors, they meet the kids, they see the room, they see that we're not just flying through hoops and circles. They end up wanting to be a part of it, and we form really rich connections. Our administrators, who no matter how hard I work, without our administrators, all the way up to the CAS, green lighting and give us a thumbs up that we can take a risk and go for it. That's how this program was born. I have our woodshop teacher who's building parts so these guys can inspect. So there's like a huge community all supporting these kids. And for me, it fills me with a sense of pride that they're doing something with it. Hopefully they're going to go someplace with it and can continue learning that information they've learned and crossing over into whatever they decide to do.
And the success of Evan Mackay is contagious. Tomorrow we'll hear from an elementary school down the street. The sky's the limit when it comes to drones. And we do have to go now. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us or reach out on social media. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.